It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Last week, Reverend Alex G. of the Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison wrote an article in the Capital Times. In the article, he says, despite Madison's identity as a liberal or progressive place, Wisconsin's capital fails its African-American community in numerous ways.
Today, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy also released a report on the, quote, vast chasm separating Wisconsin's African-American and white economic outcomes. It's across the state, noting that Wisconsin ranks second in the nation for economic disparity between blacks and whites. We've invited Reverend Alex G. to join us to discuss a situation that he's witnessed in Madison. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure being here.
Now, why did you write the article in the first place? It almost feels like, you know, with 12-step programs, you have to know you have a problem to get started. was that sort of part of what you were doing in writing this article?
Well, I think so. I've noticed a few things that if you're not indigenous to Madison, you're not really allowed to speak out against Madison. And if you're from Madison and you're doing fairly well, it's difficult to speak out because people ask, well, how can you complain? You're living a good life and you benefit from this community. And so I've straddled the fence for a number of years, but after personal experiences, just mounting up over the years, I just decided that if I don't lend my voice as a person who is indigenous to this community, then the subject matter of profiling, of mass incarceration, et cetera, would have little or no credibility. So I wrote it so that I would not betray my South Madison community where I grew up and where I know on a daily basis. People experience the things that I do.
And so in one of the points you make is that even though Madison's seen as sort of a progressive and open place, it's not as welcoming and open to African Americans in a lot of ways.
Exactly. And I tried to balance the article by showing that I'm very proud to be Madisonian, that my family's been here for 45 years. And what I really said is I want the Madisonian atmosphere that my family felt in 1970, where we weren't stigmatized by being from the west side of Chicago. We weren't viewed with suspicion that we were here for better welfare benefits or to bring crime or to bring down the graduation or the performance of students of color. I felt that the community was very affirming. My mom received 2 degrees from the University of Wisconsin, and she never went to high school. And she was on the dean's list in grad school, and she sent both my sister, Laleda, and I to the university, and we both graduated. But it seems like things have changed over the years, that we've become hoarders and we're afraid that outsiders are coming to take our city away from us. And I feel that it's much different than it was when I was a kid and the total minority population was probably less than 1%. Hmm. So I wrote it to help Madison remember its roots and not live in its rearview mirror by remembering, you know, the days of the protests over the Vietnam War or sitting in for the Black Student Union or the Black Studies program. I think we if we're not careful, we live so much in our rearview mirror that we think we have no responsibility to make things fair today. And I just wrote that because I wanted to help the community to have a healthy checkup.
Now, you mentioned the difference between the 1970s and now. That actually was something that was pointed out in the report that was done by the Center for Wisconsin Strategy, too, where they said that things are much different in Wisconsin now than they were in the 1970s. You kind of touched on that, but what do you think some of the issues are? Do you think it is sort of this don't come into Wisconsin kind of thing going on? Or
I think that that's part of it. I remember when there was talk in the mid-90s about welfare reform. The word on the street, the discussion was that we were too attractive to outside individuals who were moving here because we were paying our poor people so well that they were coming to Wisconsin so that they could make it big and become middle class. I'm being facetious. And so, but I feel that the numbers were so small in the 70s, it wasn't perceived as a threat.
Mm-hmm.
We were still a novelty. I could go 3 days without seeing someone who looked like me. I've only had 2 African-American teachers from second grade through my graduation from high school. However, there was an openness even to the kids who attended Leopold Elementary School but lived on farms in Fitchburg. There was still an openness and acceptance. I feel something's shifted. It's more combative. It just feels different, and it feels like everyone's vying for the same piece of pie. Therefore, they're being suspicious. And not as welcoming to the new kids on the block.
So do you think some of that has to do with political discussions that have happened in the state, or do you think there's more to it than that?
I think that the political discussions are part of it, but I think it just goes way back. I think when the populations began to increase and the demographics changed, and it became apparent that Madison's different. I noticed from 1980 to 1990, the African-American population in Madison doubled. Well, no one saw that coming. And then when you have increased numbers, you have increased demand. So you're wondering, well, where are the African-American police officers and librarians and mail carriers and administrators in schools? And so I suppose the broader community thought it's never been a problem up till now. Our teachers have taught everyone. So now you want inclusive curriculum and you want Black history and you want Black teachers teaching Black history. And I think just when the African-American community was being able to use the homeowner's towels, the city put the guest towels back out. And so there was a sense that you're not really from here. And when you're not from a place, then you're not as committed to it. I mean, people treat home a lot differently than they treat hotel rooms.
And to illustrate your point, in the article, you talked about how these things affect you on a regular basis, including some examples of racial profiling that you experience. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I talked about two examples of being pulled over by the police. In the 90s, it was called the Blue Blanket. And I went to tell my part-time receptionist that she didn't have to come to work. She was sick. And I was pulled over because the officer asked why I did not go into her house. And I said, well, she's my employee. I'm a male. I'm married. I'm not going to do that. And I just told her she didn't. And I didn't want to catch what she had. And he said, well, it looked like you were setting up for a drug deal and your actions fit the profile of a drug dealer. And I had a black suit on. I was going to take pictures for our church. And that was two blocks from my church. My church was on Badger Road. And this was right at the Park Bank parking lot in broad daylight. It was embarrassing. The second time, I mentioned just a few years ago, I was meeting my associate, who's a white gentleman, and he was in our parking lot waiting for us. We have a standing Saturday evening meeting, and he was waiting. And the police pulled me over and said they were looking for someone in a red car. My car is black. And started asking me why was I there and who I was. And so I started showing ID. My white colleague, who was sitting there in his car, got out, walked over to the police, which I, as an African-American male, would never do. Not out of fear of being shot by Madison police. That's not my concern. But being embarrassed or yelled at, or I just learned you don't do that. When the police pull you over, you put your hands at 10 and 2 on the steering wheel and you answer the questions nicely. He started, engaging in small talk, and they asked him if I was who I said I was. Not once did they ask him why he was there or who he was or if they could see ID. But yet they wanted him to corroborate my identity without even seeing his identity. And so in the story, I mentioned that when my church was broken into in that same parking lot, I described myself to the 911, to the dispatch, just because I didn't want any confusion. I didn't want them to come in after calling about a break-in and thinking that I might be the assailant. So I described my sweater, my jeans, the color, make a mark on my collar of my car, just because I didn't want the frustration and the professional embarrassment of someone coming over asking me who I was and what I was doing there while a guy was downstairs wrecking my church.
Hmm. Wow. It sounds like those experiences could make you a little grumpy.
Well, they do. You know what's interesting? And this is what I try to help people to understand. Although I may insinuate that there is some profiling, let me back up. I think there's definitely some profiling. Whether or not that's solely on race, I'm sure that that's a huge, huge part of it. I never was able to get the officer to say, yes, I pulled you over because you're black. So there's never any proof. That's what I think I'm trying to say. But when the next time that incident happens, it awakens all of the other experiences. So I can put it behind me because you have to be able to function and to be a team member and to not walk around totally violent. So I forget about it until the very next time it happens, and then it all comes back. And I think when I called the police and described myself, and that was just a few months ago, it brought back the other experiences. And I think at that point, I started writing the article in my head.
So the article has gotten a lot of response from
people. It's gotten a lot of response. I mean, writing is not new to me, but I don't really write for newspapers. I mean, I've written a few books, and so it's interesting. You write a book and it's not in print for another year. It's very interesting to write something and it's on the front cover the next week. Cap Times called me over the weekend and told me that it was the top read story. It has more than 4,000 shares. So not hits, but 4,000 shares. And it is by far the leading read article last month. Well, that's flooring me, but I'm receiving all kinds of calls, strangers are stopping me and introducing themselves to me. And people want to help. People are saying, we hear you. We believe it. What do we do? What can we do to be very helpful? So I have to say, we want to see the action, but the outpouring, the response makes me really proud to be a part of this community.
Wow. Now, you've been a pastor in this area for how long?
Oh, about 28, 30 years.
Now, how come you never brought this up earlier? You said, what sort of motivated you now to do this?
Oh, I talk about it. So yeah. I've written about it. I write about it in the Madison Times. So I've written about it.
Yeah.
What really push buttons for me. And again, this is when I was at Downtown Rotary giving a talk about mass incarceration. And this isn't meant to be a reflection or a poor reflection on Rotary. It's just where I was when things clicked and when the straw broke the camel's back.
Right, right.
And when this woman kept pushing me and congratulating me on not being angry and then started comparing me to other African-American leaders who are my colleagues and friends, I just said, OK, now I'm benign and I'm safe. And then now you want to put a wedge between me and my colleague. And this is the thanks I get for coming and saying what I'm saying. And everyone in that room didn't do that. There was just this one particular woman. But when she did it, I said, all right, I'm going public. And so I called my friend Phil Haslinger, who I knew was a writer. He's a pastor now. He introduced me to Paul Fanlund. And I told him the story. And Paul was listening with being cordial. I mean, Paul's a nice guy. I don't know him well. But when I told the part about calling 911 and describing myself, he dropped his head, and when he raised it, he said, I never think of describing myself when I call 911. I want you to write me 3,000 words. I want to put this on the front cover. He just laid everything out. Because I think at that point he realized I wasn't walking around saying, my food is cold because I'm black. You know, my car gets ticketed because I'm black. It's colder in my house because it's black. I think he realized, all right, whether or not he had to do that, the fact that this man who has served this community from everything as a paper boy to an assistant to David Ward when he was chancellor years ago to a pastor, that if he has to think about describing himself before dialing 911, which is his right as a taxpayer, that's important enough to me that he thinks he has to do it. And Paul said, I want you to write that. So I think it came because of a culmination of things. But I think just trying to prove to someone that I wasn't angry revealed just how angry I was. And I think that was the proverbial straw that broke that camel's back.
Wow. I mean, there was another thing that jumped out in the piece you wrote where somebody said, well, you do have a nice car, you know.
Yes. And I think, and I said at which point I realized that not only was I angry, I was hurt and disillusioned.
Yeah.
Because that was just
so that would
sort
make
of
somebody,
the apex of
somebody think you're a drug dealer because
right.
you have a nice
like,
car.
Like, what else would they think, Alex? I'm thinking, wow, my mom moved me here as a single mom going through a divorce and paid for my college tuition. I didn't have any student loans. I lived at home. She paid for my college tuition so I could get a job. My wife and I had no children. I was a University of Wisconsin employee, as was my wife. I could afford a $10,000 car, which is, I mean, I say that joke. That's how much it cost. It was a Chevy Toyota. It was a Nova.
Right.
Yet my friend thought, well, that was a pretty nice, he thought you're driving a pretty nice car. So the guy's just doing his job. Cut him some slack. And it was very sincere. We're friends to this day. That wasn't a mean email or back in those days a fax or a letter.
Right.
He was just trying to help me to make sense of it. It was his way of saying, Alex, it wasn't about race. It wasn't because he was a bad guy. He's protecting the community because people who look like you commit drunk crimes, particularly those with nice cars. And I'm thinking, this is Madison. We probably have more blacks who have degrees than who are drug dealers.
So you've gotten people's attention. And what's next?
Yes.
What's the next thing? What are you going to do next?
Well, I mean, I'd be lying if I said I saw this coming. I mean, you know, I run a nonprofit, an urban leadership development organization. I pastor a church. I'm doing hospital visits. I'm traveling. I'm a speaker. I did not know that there was going to be this kind of response. I thought it would be on the front cover. You'd be the flavor of the day, and then it'll go away, and then I'll tuck it away in an album and show my grandchildren one day. But now I'm realizing I'll probably have to cut my vacation short, which is all right. I mean, sometimes an opportunity calls you. And I want to spend some time meeting with political leaders. I've had one reach out to me. The county executive called me and said he'd like to talk. I'd like to meet with other elected officials just to say, hey, I have my point of view and I've got some emotion behind this, but I'm part of this community and I want to help to bring solutions. I want to bring people to the table who are not normally to the table. I want to listen to disenfranchised folks and hear their story. But I'm also spending time listening to school teachers and concern. Most of the emails I'm getting are from white Madisonians who are saying, we want to do something. How do we help? How do we support? So I want to hear their voices as well as help to network them in places already established programs and organizations that they can plug into. So I think the next step is really doing a little bit more homework, because this is catching me off guard a bit. But putting together planning teams and having some community events. And I received a call from Cap Times today, and they want to actually host the community forum where I want to, along with community leaders — this is not the Alex G Show — with community leaders, make some recommendations for some very solid next steps. We don't want to fall into the typical Madisonian trap of just having other discussions and white papers and coalitions. We want to recommend probably a half dozen doable things that we can take on to the next year, year and a half. So we could say we haven't fixed everything, but we've done something other than talk. And so in the next several weeks to the next month, I want to present some of those things once I've had a chance to really go deeper and have more talks with my cabinet of friends and associates.
Well, Reverend G, thanks so much for coming in today. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate the interview.
Alex G is a pastor at the Fountain of Life Covenant Church. And thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.